Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. These are rough times for the Olympic Games. Fewer and fewer cities want to deal with the headaches and costs of hosting the Games. And so the International Olympic Committee practically leapt into the arms of Paris and Los Angeles, two rare cities both willing and ready to host Summer Games. This hour, On Point, keeping the Olympic torch burning in hard times. You can join us on air or online. Would you want your city to host the Games if it had a chance? Do the Olympic Games still matter to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, later this hour, why are Viagra and Cialis pulling their commercials from NFL games? But first to the Olympics. We start in Los Angeles, chosen for either the 2024 or the 2028 games. There's a whole story in that. We'll get to it in a minute. But joining me now is Jerry Sullivan, editor of the Los Angeles Business Journal. By the way, there's a link to his paper's coverage of what the games mean to LA on our website, onpointradio.org. Jerry, thanks for making the time.
Hi, John. Thank you.
Jerry, I got to say, when I hear that Olympic music, it sort of wells something up in me. It's inspiring. Does it inspire Los Angeles?
It will. And, you know, this is kind of deja vu all over again for us. If you recall, when Los Angeles hosted the 84 games, the Olympic movement was not in great shape. In fact, the Olympic movement was reinvented at the 1984 Los Angeles Games, and it sounds like it might need a little reinvention again, and we'll see if Los Angeles can do that trick. But understand also, this is Los Angeles. There's a lot to do. We tend not to get too excited about things this far in advance, much more closer to date in terms of our sense of anticipation and excitement.
Let me ask you about that Olympic model. As I recall, the executive who led that reinvention was a guy named Peter Uberoth, who also had served as baseball commissioner. What exactly was the secret to that model, and what is outmoded about it now?
Yeah, I don't think there was a huge secret. You know, Mr. Uberoth, who still lives in Southern California and actually is the managing general partner of Pebble Beach now, and has various other business interests. And I chat with him occasionally. And, you know, I think it was just sort of a common sense, hard work model. They took, if you recall, I think the 76 games were in Montreal and really were troublesome financially for Montreal. And then in 80, we boycotted the Moscow Olympics. And, of course, in 84, Moscow returned the favor. So those games went. That was the context of those games. And Peter Uberoth started the sponsorship model, started getting businesses involved. I'll tell you, one of the most powerful things he did, I think, was just ask, especially the people of the city who, you know, you still hear stories of what went on during those Olympics and the sort of community and camaraderie. And it's almost hard to believe. You know, it's the stuff of Coca-Cola commercials.
Jerry, one of the issues that's been raised by some of the venues is that they do construction for residential housing for Olympic athletes. They build stadiums to host competition, but then they become white elephants once it's over. Is there anything from the 84 Olympics that is still in use in Los Angeles and even potentially could be of use in the games a decade from now?
Well, yes, we have a 100,000-seat Coliseum that was actually used in the 32 Olympics and the 84 Olympics and will be used again. So, no, there's plenty Dodger Stadium was used. Dodger Stadium is still here. You know, the spread.
But was there new stuff built for the 84 games that is still
there? There was not a lot, and don't forget, not all of it was in Los Angeles or even, I believe, California. I mean, there were some of the events were scattered quite broadly. So that one huge one that you might be looking for, really, as to the best of my knowledge or my ability to recall at the moment, that really isn't there. I'm trying to think if there was the bicycle facility or anything like that, and not really. UCLA was used as the Olympic Village, and I think the plan calls for UCLA to be used as the Olympic Village again. So, I mean, a lot of it is a step and repeat process on this.
Jerry, one of the things that was unusual about the situation was we had a competition for the 2024 games, and Paris and Los Angeles had emerged, but then the games, seeing few competitors for the job of hosting, decided to award those two cities that had bid for 2024. Both of them were given hosting, although it was left unclear as to which was going to host 2024 and which was going to host 2028. Now, Paris has indicated some of the space that it's going to use would not be available for 2028. Does Los Angeles, so far as you've been able to determine, care? Are they fine with accepting 2028 and letting Paris have 2024?
I think so, generally. And I think, you know, this is a case of anybody who's for it will be for it in 2024 or 2028, and anyone who might be against this would probably be against it in both. And again, in Los Angeles, it's such a far 2024 is such a far timeline. It's not exactly top of mind on most of the populace right now, and so I don't know that it matters much. To be clear, let's face it. This is kind of like winning by being the last person, last city standing. I mean, everyone else kind of dropped away. But I think, generally, if that's a default victory, fine, we'll take it.
Well, speaking of that, President Trump tweeted the other day that he was working very hard to get the Olympics for Los Angeles. Is there evidence that the president had anything to do with this?
Not to my knowledge. And the politics of this is always gets a little bit, I'm sure, difficult to discern, but I have no knowledge of that.
The other question I had about Los Angeles is, have they identified who the new Peter Ueberroth would be to be the executive in charge?
You know, that's a great question. I've been asking that question myself, and we're actually working on a piece about the civic committee that's involved. You know, I don't know that anyone's clearly taken that mantle. I think that Casey Wasserman probably, if most people, if you brought up the subject and asked most people who would come to mind, I think Casey Wasserman has been very involved in the sports business and now as a sports management, a talent management. And, of course, is the grandson of a legendary movie industry executive, Lou Wasserman, and well-known in town, and presents a very youthful, energetic face to this.
Let's bring a caller into the conversation. We've got Amy on the line from Corydon, Indiana. Amy, you're on point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John.
What's your question?
Well, it's not really a question. It's more of an observation. I have family members that extend into L.A. and the surrounding areas. I've been there recently. I have seen what is happening there in L.A., and I don't believe that L.A. is in any kind of position to be hosting anything. They have made a travesty of their government, and they are overtaxing the business owners there already. Many, many businesses have closed, and others are hurting drastically. How can they possibly contribute to such a large project? I understand that they want to take it on because they feel maybe it'll bring some business back. But frankly, L.A. is dead. Hollywood is dead. Everything that comes out of there these days is just bad news. Berkeley is bad news. I mean,
Amy, thanks so much. We are fortunate to have somebody who knows quite a bit about Los Angeles and the business community. Jerry, respond to Amy. Is L.A. dead?
No. Rumors of Los Angeles' demise are greatly exaggerated. That doesn't match with what I'm seeing. Los Angeles has some problems. We have right now a homeless situation that is difficult and increasingly visible and increasingly getting the attention, and the business community actually is playing a lead role, I think, on that. But it's a problem. We have an extraordinarily expensive housing market, which aggravates a lot of other things. And we have traffic, as everybody who's been here knows. We have our problems, but if you look at the unemployment rate in Los Angeles County, you'd be really hard-pressed to make the case that Los Angeles is dead or dying or even ailing. In fact, if you look at most of the numbers, you would say it seems quite vibrant, certainly with problems.
Do you know what Amy was referring to when she talked about tax burdens causing so many businesses to close? Does that sound to you like something that's just simply not accurate?
Well, I don't think it's that discernible. There's a variety of tax burdens in California, some of which that hit small business owners is actually a state income tax. Listen, the city of Los Angeles could do better on its tax and fee structure, as well as a lot of its services. But I don't see any one sort of silver bullet of what the caller was suggesting.
Well, here's hoping that the Los Angeles Business Journal can stay in business. Jerry Sullivan, he's the editor of the Los Angeles Business Journal. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. The Olympic Committee did a strange thing this week. Instead of just nominating one city to host the 2024 Games, it nominated two, 2024 and 2028. And that tells us something. You can join the conversation. Are the Games still a big deal in your home? Do the opening and closing ceremonies move you? Does the world still need these Games? Joining me now is Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College and author of Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup, and the forthcoming Rio 2016, Olympic Myths, Hard Realities. And also joining us is Nancy Armour. She's sports columnist for USA Today. She was a sports writer for the Associated Press for 20 years and is pretty much an Olympics maven. The 2018 Winter Games in South Korea will be the 12th Olympic Games she's attended. Nancy joins us from Chicago. Andrew and Nancy, thanks for being with me.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Andrew, let me ask you this. We just heard from Jerry with the Los Angeles Business Journal about LA's eagerness to take the mantle of hosting the Olympics, having had a good experience in 1984. Why is it that so many other cities, including Boston, have decided otherwise?
Fundamentally, because Boston is unique. Los Angeles in 1984 was unique. They were able to turn a surplus of just over $200 million. All of the other cases since 1964 have resulted in large cost overruns and deficits. The deficit that has typically occurred in the last 10 years is you see an expense on the order of $15 to $20 billion after you've built the 35 venues for the Summer Games. You've done all of the infrastructural work. You're spending $15 to $20 billion. You bring in about $4 or $5 billion in revenue, and you have a short-term deficit of $10 or $15 billion. And that's even excluding some of the more exaggerated losses that we saw in Sochi or we saw in Beijing in 2008. The IOC would like to argue, I think, that the short-term losses are offset by long-term gains. They say it should promote tourism, it should promote foreign investment, it should promote foreign trade, it should promote fitness for your population. In fact, the empirical evidence doesn't support any of those long-run contentions. And hence, cities around the world are noticing that this is not a good investment to make. So that's basically what's been driving the lack of interest.
Andrew, does the fact that Los Angeles in 1984 was successful and others have been less successful, is that about the nature of Los Angeles or the nature of the management of those games, or is it about changes in the Olympic Games themselves?
Well, it's a little bit about Los Angeles itself and a little bit about the job that Peter Uberoff did. You and Jerry covered that pretty well, I think. Look, Los Angeles today, certainly, and almost to the same extent back in 1984, Los Angeles has the venues. It has to do very, very little construction. In fact, if they get the games in 24 or 28, they have to do no permanent athletic venue construction. There's one temporary construction they'll have to do for water events, but that's it. And Los Angeles has the transportation infrastructure. They have the necessary communications infrastructure. They have the necessary hospitality infrastructure. Basically, Los Angeles doesn't have to do any building. And it's the building that runs the bill up to $15 to $20 billion. Los Angeles will also benefit from getting very healthy revenue from tickets and from sponsorships. So the Los Angeles bid for either 2024 or 28, in my view, is quite responsible. But Los Angeles is sui generis. There aren't any other cities out there like it. Even Paris is going to have to spend quite a bit of money. They're going to use a lot of existing venues, but they're also going to have to build new venues, and they're going to have to build an Olympic Village. So Los Angeles is in a very special situation. In 1984, they had something else going for them. After the disaster, the economic disaster in Montreal in 1976, and the political disaster in Munich with the invasion by terrorists of the Israeli compound and subsequent killing of 15 people, and the Mexico games where there was very severe political repression and all sorts of other problems in 1968, nobody wanted a bid for the Olympics. For 1984. I'm talking now in 1978 when the bidding was happening. Los Angeles was the only city that was bidding. And hence, Los Angeles was in the unique position back then to go to the IOC and have some bargaining leverage. And one of the things that Uberoff said to the IOC is, look, we're willing to host the games, but we're not willing to provide a financial guarantee, which is what the IOC has always required before and after that. So Los Angeles didn't have to put up any money at all for guarantee, and the IOC had to go along with that. The other thing that Los Angeles said is, you have to let us use our Olympic stadium from 1932, which was the Los Angeles Coliseum. Again, the IOC had to say yes. And Los Angeles said, you have to let us use the USC dormitories and the UCLA dormitories rather than building an Olympic Village. Again, the IOC said yes. So, you know, put all of those things together, and Los Angeles was able to do all of it very successfully
in
84.
Armour, let me ask you this. Does the International Olympic Committee, for some of the reasons that Andrew was just outlining, believe that it's in crisis? And if so, is the solution to the crisis to, in effect, make permanent Olympic hosts of the handful of plug-and-play cities that can do this easily, like Los Angeles?
Sadly, no. I don't think the IOC realizes that. You know, they can talk a good game, you know, with their Agenda 2020 project and talking about paring back costs for bidding and costs for hosting a games. But we haven't seen that actually translate into reality. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen until they wind up with a situation where there is only one country or there are no countries bidding. You know, we're seeing trouble already with the bidding for the 2026 Winter Games, and the IOC is going to have to make a decision when it gets to a point that all it has are, you know, countries like, that are run by dictators are the only ones bidding for the Games or wanting to host the Games. It's going to have a very deep look at itself and its values.
Nancy, how many cities are there in the world, like Los Angeles, for either winter or summer games that can simply accept it with their existing infrastructure?
Not many. Maybe two, three, maybe four for the summer games. Los Angeles obviously being one. Sydney, I think London still, though obviously you'd have to do some work with the stadium.
New York?
No. New York not with the – they don't have the rooms – for the Village, they could find them, but it's not ready-made like it is with USC and UCLA with the proximity of those campuses to each other and the proximity to the venues.
Tokyo?
Tokyo could be, but we're seeing that they're having problems. You know, they host in 2020, and they've had horrendous overruns because they had promised that they were going to use some of their venues from the last time that they hosted, and some of those are not working out as they planned. So I don't even know if you could say that. And in terms of winter games, maybe Salt Lake, Vancouver, probably you could go back to Sochi because they have not, though they've turned much of the Olympic Park into a Formula One track. There are not many because these are, you know, as everybody mentions, you build some of these venues and they are automatically, you know, the minute that the door opened, they're a white elephant because you don't have a majority of the population wanting to do canoe kayak or biathlon in when the Olympics are not there. That's just unrealistic.
Let's bring one of our listeners into the conversation. We've got Jenny on the line from Saranac Lake, New York. Jenny, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I'm calling. My son competed in the 2010 and the 2014 in ski jumping, and we fly the flag proudly for summer or winter Olympics, and I understand the economic disadvantage for large cities. I just think part of the problem is the Olympic movement has gotten so big, and the Olympics themselves are so large that it's just so hard for a big city to do. That being said, Lake Placid, not that we could host an Olympics, so people here think they can. We still use our venues. We still use the venues from 32 and 80. And our kids are learning. We had, in my son's year, 2010, there was 9 local athletes that went to the Olympics. We are proud Olympians in this village, in this community. And we hate to see the Olympic movement go.
Did your son, by the way, have a good competitive experience?
He had a great competitive experience. You know, the U.S. is not traditionally super competitive in ski jumping, but he continued after the 2010. He was 17. He continued on and competed in the World Cup for the next 4 years. He did retire after 2014 and went to college because, you know, thought that was a better option for him. But I love to hear about the Olympics. I was at the 1980. My husband went to the Salt Lake Olympics. We've both been to the Vancouver and the Sochi. That music, like you said earlier, it just brings chills to you.
Doesn't it?
And, yeah, it does.
Jenny, thanks so much for your call, and congratulations on your son's success. Andrew, let me ask you about one basic thing. Jenny said the Olympics have gotten so big. If they've gotten so big and television networks pay so much money to be able to air them, why doesn't that money produce an economic dividend?
Okay. I mean, there are lots of issues here, John, and they're all quite complicated. But basically, the IOC takes in somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 billion for an Olympic cycle in the Winter and Summer Olympics. They share somewhere on the order of $1.2, $1.3 billion of their television and their top sponsorship money with the Olympic hosts. The rest of the money stays at first with the IOC, and then the IOC distributes 90% of that money to international sports federations and to national Olympic committees, and with the goal of promoting sports development and athletic training internationally. So the existing model is one where the host city gets maybe 30% of the revenue that's generated internationally by television and sponsorships. If the model changed and there was more support and more subsidy from the IOC, then some of the cases of losses from hosting cities would no longer be losses. But many of them, like Sochi and Beijing, would still have substantial losses. In terms of Jenny's suggestion that maybe it could go back to Lake Placid, one of the things that's very important to remember is that in addition to the athletic venues, whether it's Summer or Winter Olympics, the IOC requires an Olympic Village. The Olympic Village these days is an expense on the order of $2 or $3 billion. They also require a media village where all of the media people will reside. They also require an international broadcasting center, and that can be another $1 billion. They also require a great deal of ceremonial space. To host the Summer Olympics these days requires somewhere on the order of 5,000 to 8,000 acres of land. That's not something that most cities can easily give up. And when you build a venue that didn't previously exist, it meant that it didn't exist because there was no demand for its use. You have to create demand for its use after the games.
Right.
The record for doing that is not very good. And that means you have to maintain, you have to spend, not only you have to build the venue, but then you have to maintain it to keep it from going to seed. So there are lots of complications involved.
Let's go back to another listener. We've got Evelina calling from Livonia, Michigan. Evelina, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. Hi, John. My comment isn't so much on where it's going to be currently as much as in the future. I've kind of seen, like everyone has, that the cities really end up losing money, and then the facilities end up just kind of sitting there, wasted space, wasted efforts. And I would suggest the committee look into just keeping the Summer Olympics in Greece, Winter Olympics, say, in Switzerland. And then those countries would be the host countries, and then invite other countries to sponsor the Olympics every 4 years. And, you know, that way you've got permanent facilities. They're used regularly. They can use as training sites. So, you know, I'd just like input on that.
Evelina, that sounds like a pretty good suggestion to me. Nancy Armour, what do you think?
That's a suggestion that's been raised many times and over the years, and is getting raised more and more frequently now, whether it's one permanent host for the winter, one permanent host for the summer, or a rotation among, you know, three or four cities. I think it's an idea worth considering. Not only would you have the venues existing year after, you know, cycle after cycle, you could also use them as training facilities for less advantaged countries in between the games. And I honestly, in talking with athletes, they don't care where the games are. You know, it's the spectacle of the games themselves. It's the competition. It's seeing the other athletes in the Olympic Village. That's what matters to them. You know, whether it's in Athens or Los Angeles or Paris, yeah, it might be fun after the games, but during the games, they don't care. They, you know, it's everything else, not the site that matters to them.
We had a recent Olympics in Athens, didn't we?
Yes, in 2004, which is it has been attributed to sparking the financial crisis in Greece because they way overspent and they way overbuilt, and very few of their venues are being used now. But the idea of permanent sites would require a change in mindset or shift in mindset from the IOC members and the federation, the sport federation members. And frankly, I don't know that they have it in them right now.
Andrew, let me ask you for a quick answer on this. What do you think of the idea of permanent hosting cities?
I think it's a fine idea. I'm not sure that Greece is the place to go. It would be nice symbolically to create a new Olympic cluster and village somewhere between Olympia and Athens. One of the problems is that Greece and Athens don't have the money to do that. They don't have the resources. It's very expensive to build all of that. Once you've built it, you've got to maintain it. And it's nice also, Nancy's idea is a great idea, use the venues for training in between the four-year intervals of the games. But there's not going to be enough use for during the training. You're going to have to spend millions of dollars to maintain those facilities. What are you going to do with the Olympic Village that has to host 16,000 people in between the four-year periods? So I think that it's a good idea to find one place. I think Los Angeles would be such a place. There might be one or two other places. But it's not easy to do.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. That's some of the music from the colorful parade in the stadium at the opening ceremony of the 2016 Rio Olympic Games. I'm talking with Andrew Zimbalist. He's professor of economics at Smith College, and Nancy Armour, sports columnist for USA Today. You can join the conversation. How would you improve the games, make them really as glorious and as uniting as all the lofty speeches? Let me ask you, Nancy Armour, about the process by which bidding takes place, which we see fewer bidders. But is there much or any hint of corruption in the process, as we've seen, say, in the World Cup?
Well, there was a huge, obviously, the bid scandal back in before the Salt Lake City Games, 2002. I think it's probably less overt now, but I mean, you'd have to be incredibly naive to think that money's not being exchanged, promises are not being exchanged. You know, we've seen allegations of payouts from some of, whether it's the Rio organizers or the Tokyo organizers to the man who was the previous head of the Track and Field Federation. These are not angels who are running the IOC, and to expect that they are doing all of their business above and beyond, above board, is, like I said, it's incredibly naive.
Do you think that there is any prospect that because of financial problems, because of the way the media environment's changing, because of the difficulty of getting cities involved, that the Olympic movement could come to an end?
Anything is possible. And I think that is one thing that the IOC needs to be very mindful of. They are concerned about the shifting demographics. You see that with the Winter Olympics, with all of the addition of the snowboarding, ski cross type sports, because that brings in a younger audience. They are very concerned about the appeal aging out. But yes, when you look at the media climate, the expense of this, these are all things that the IOC should be very, very, very concerned about. And the question is whether they really understand or appreciate the danger and how real the threat could be.
Andrew, what are the chances, in your view, that 25 years from now there will not be an Olympic Games?
Oh, I think there'll still be Olympic Games. What's going to happen, though, is that the IOC is going to be forced to change its business model. Indeed, they've already changed it. They changed it this week before our very eyes. Instead of having an open international competition to see who gets the honor to host the Games in 2028, the IOC was afraid to have that competition and have nobody participate. So they decided to give it to two cities in two successive 4-year periods. So it's the business model that has to change. The IOC is going to have to give more of its revenue to the host cities. They're going to have to contemplate what we were talking before about, which is to have one city or two cities host the games, summer games and the winter games. Stop trying to make the Olympics into a construction event. It was never decided to make it a construction event. It's supposed to be an athletic event. Let's take care of having the athletes participate in good facilities and stop worrying about rebuilding Shangri-La in a new city every 4 years.
Nancy, just to go back to the point you mentioned a moment ago about having to recalibrate for younger audiences. Is that why they're coming up with these made-up competitions like three-on-three basketball?
Absolutely. And, you know, they have to. Sports have to adapt. Everything has to adapt. You know, you see in any kind of industry or sport. But yes, these are all things that are either going to be more popular to, you know, be viewed on a streaming device or more, you know, more popular with the 18 to 24 demographic. You know, the IOC has to adapt to survive like any other organization. And like Andrew said, part of that is going to be changing its business model, but it also has to change its competitive model too.
Let's take another call. We've got Bill on the line from Lake George, New York. Bill, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, John. One little point that's kind of not totally related, but the Olympics are... if you think about things we do in the world, the Olympics is the best. One of the best things we do is a world of 200 some odd countries, and the worst thing we do is put billions of dollars into war machines. It's just the, you know, you're talking about money, and we. How much did it cost to build 100,000 nuclear weapons in the last 50 years? It's the best money we spend. I don't care. If it's too much money, it's not very much money compared to how much money we spend sending our nice young 18-year-old kids off to become military people to go shoot and kill other people. It's the best thing we got going in the world.
Bill, thanks so much for your perspective. Andrew, do you say? A little context there, a little perspective.
Well, sure. It's much better to have nations competing on the athletic field than to have them competing on the battlefield. There's no question about that. But let's be realistic about what the Olympics has become. The Olympics talks about values like human rights and democracy, but then that they go ahead and they give Beijing – two Olympic Games in 2008 and 2022. They don't pay attention to human rights when they make their awards of the games. They don't pay attention to the environment when they make their awards of the games. Let's take the Olympics back to its goals, to the virtuous ideas that it espouses, and change the actual behavior of the IOC, then we can say that it's one of the better things that we do in the world. It's certainly better than war today, but there are a lot of better things we could be doing with money.
Nancy, to the point that Bill just raised, when having covered so many Olympic Games, do you still find the hair going up on the back of your neck when you hear the Olympic music and you see the parade and you watch some of the competition?
Oh, absolutely. You know, obviously I am have been a very big and vocal critic of the IOC, but I love the Olympics. I love the idea behind them. I even like the spectacle of them. And when I'm covering Olympics, there is at least one or two times during the 16 days that I look around and say, God, I'm so lucky to be here. So I hope for that reason alone is that they can find a way to fix this.
Well, we were lucky to have you today. Nancy Armour, sports columnist for USA Today. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. Andrew, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
Now, in a moment, Viagra pulls its TV ads from the NFL games. This is On Point. Well, it's not just the International Olympic Committee. The National Football League is feeling the heat, too. Viagra and Cialis recently announced they will stop buying TV commercials during NFL games. To explain, David Steele joins me from Laurel, Maryland. He's a writer for SportingNews.com. You can find a link to his story today on the NFL's flagging audiences on our website, onpointradio.org. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on, John.
Okay, David. We have all gotten so accustomed to Viagra, Cialis, the tubs that the people are sitting in, all that sort of stuff. Where is that going?
Yeah, it's fascinating because we have gotten accustomed to it as an audience. You know, we made the jokes about it, and presumably for years, those two companies really cashed in a lot on that. The fact that they're backing out isn't as small a deal as some people want to make it. I mean, it would seem like it's only a couple of companies, but it's just sort of a negative omen for some for what's been going on in the league the last year. The TV ratings slipped for the first time in a long time last season, and to see a couple of major advertisers drop out. And to see that there are signs that there may not necessarily be another stream of advertisers waiting to step right back in, it means that a major, major, major revenue stream for the NFL could be diminishing.
So why are they leaving?
Because the NFL is going through right now several crises of varying sizes, and it's not totally clear exactly how much each one is affecting the NFL and whether they've had all major effects on the ratings, because it's just so far just a 1 year drop. But all the controversy over how they've handled concussions, the terrible effects that they've had on players, including the ones who have committed suicide over the years, the various fights with the players over discipline, whether it's too hard or too soft on them, the domestic violence problems.
But in the case of these two companies, isn't it the fact that these drugs are coming off of patent protection, and therefore Viagra and Cialis by advertising would be advertising to boost generic alternatives that they couldn't profit from?
Well, that would be a factor as long as somebody else is coming in to replace that revenue on the NFL broadcast, and that's still kind of the big unknown about that. Again, there have been some signs in some various reports in the last couple of weeks that advertisers aren't really lining up in the way they have in the past years to jump in and advertise on what has still been for many, many years by far the most popular sport in this country. So I think everyone is sort of still weighing exactly what the impact of that is. But if somebody doesn't come in and replace that, then I think it would be the sign of a major problem that the NFL is going to have to address.
Why have NFL games been such an attractive advertising opportunity for those two companies?
Because of the target audience. Men from, I guess, age 18 to 45, I think, is the target demographic, somewhere in that range. And obviously the upper range is the exact target of those particular products.
Yeah, I don't think too many 18-year-olds are involved.
Probably not. You know, I mean, I don't know what goes on in the background of if there are other alternative uses for it, for either one of those for younger men. But if they're seeing some sort of a sign that that target audience is going elsewhere, if they're going away from the NFL, if they're driven away by the NFL, if there are other, you know, messages that the league is sending or the sport is sending that Viagra and Cialis and products like that don't necessarily want to have themselves associated with, that they'd rather go to that there's another vehicle for that product that they'd rather use than the NFL, then the NFL is the NFL loses out.
What is your feeling, David, and that of people that you talk to about whether the ratings decline is a permanent feature as a consequence of both the fracturing of the media landscape, also the issues with concussion and growing questions about the sport? Is that something that we're going to see again this year, or is there reason to think that that was a 1 year kind of problem?
Well, the problem itself of the issues that the league has had to address, including the concussions, including things like domestic violence, the big problem that they dealt with the Patriots and Tom Brady and Deflategate, and some of the doubts about just the integrity of the league overall. People have been watching for several years, and I think a lot of people are wondering, is this ever really going to hit the NFL where it hurts, you know, in the wallets? And I think some people had been anticipating it, but the more and more the time went on, and people realize, well, the ratings haven't gone down yet, so apparently the NFL is going to survive and ride this out, and they continue to be the what a lot of people have called the nonstick football league. That's going to continue. The fact that this happened the first time, I think a lot of people are looking at it. Maybe this has been sort of a delayed reaction just to the mountain of problems that the league and Commissioner Roger Goodell have to address. So it may end up proving to be just a blip on the radar, but a lot of people are going to be watching this year to see whether or not it happens for a second straight year, and then it becomes, and then you start to recognize it as an actual trend.
The departure of these two big advertisers obviously leaves a hole. From what you've been able to determine, are there obvious targets for who would fill that hole, whether it's automobile manufacturers or other people who want to hit that demographic, that male middle-aged audience?
Well, there are certain advertisers that have just become sort of synonymous with the league, that you see their ads on the games like every single week, always connected to all their programming, played up really big in the Super Bowl. Automobiles are obviously one of them. Movies are a huge part of them. You watch the Super Bowl, there's a million movie previews that are on there. Beer and alcohol, our products are always big. I mean, the Budweiser ads are always just huge sort of measuring sticks for how popular those are. And all the products that are tied into those, and obviously soft drinks, things like that. So there are a lot of ways to measure whether or not any of those are starting to back away for the NFL. And, you know, there's still very, you know, the longstanding traditional ties to all those products. So
is there reason to think, David, that the gender composition of the NFL audience is changing in any significant way? Are more women watching or fewer women watching, for that matter?
There are more women aged in the NFL, but that also means that there are more women that are actively reacting to some of the issues that the league has had, and that includes, again, domestic violence, concussions. Mothers obviously are the ones who make a lot of decisions about whether their sons actually play football, how deeply they are engaged in football. So they've always been a big part of it. The question is whether or not the NFL has really addressed that very well, has really reached out to them in ways that female fans really want to be. So, again, that's going to bear watching in the near future as well, because you know, their segment of the audience is going to be vital to whether the NFL continues to grow or if they stall or if they start to decline.
Quick, let me get a quick answer from you on this. Are we seeing college football ratings decline?
They're still going up. The money's going up. The ratings are going up. There seems to be a tilt toward that, toward their popularity. So it'll be interesting to see how that reflects on what's going on with the NFL as well.
David Steele covers football and more for SportingNews.com. He joined me from Laurel, Maryland. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, we unpack To the Bone, the Netflix film about anorexia. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.